Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Lawmakers spent part of the week vetting proposals that would increase Delaware's personal income tax to deal with the state's budget woes.
So that we're not having these big ups and downs. We're trying to make that trajectory. It's always going to be like a little roller coaster, but make it smoother to avoid these significant cuts that we do.
Political reporter James Dawson joins us to discuss those plans and this week's other legislative news. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also look back at last week's Firefly Music Festival and what's next for the event, as well as hear about changes coming to Concord Mall. Plus, History Matters continues its look at jazz in Wilmington, and we hear a piece from students in our Generation Voice Youth Media Project in the Brandywine School District. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The clock is ticking on lawmakers who now have a week to completely erase a $350 million deficit and pass a balanced 2018 state budget. The battleground this week was taxes, specifically raising Delaware's personal income tax, where dueling Democratic proposals are on the table. At the same time, other pieces of key legislation moved ahead as the countdown to June 30th and the end of work for this year reaches the home stretch. Political reporter James Dawson was on the front lines at Lake Hall all week, joins us once again to give us a better sense of where things stand. Hi, James. How you doing?
Hey, doing well, Tom. How about you?
Well, let's start off with the two tax proposals. We've talked about them before. Leadership's plan to raise taxes across the board and add one new higher earner tax bracket, and then another from the more progressive side of the Democratic Party to add two new brackets. What's the scorecard on these plans? Which one actually winds up raising more revenue?
The one backed by Democratic leadership that hikes brackets across the board. It would raise more than $210 million once it fully takes effect late next year. The other plan, relying on the two new high-income tax brackets instead of one, would raise about half of that, according to state officials. So you see other Democrats starting to publicly support the wide-based plan for a couple reasons. First, it brings in more money, like we just talked about. And second, because they say it's more recession-proof. When Delaware goes through another economic downturn, eventually, they want to be sure that they won't be taking a bigger hit and having to figure out new ways to cover any kind of projected shortfall.
So where do we stand on GOP support for either of these plans or any kind of personal income tax hike?
Yeah, it's still not popular. So on Thursday, House and Senate Republicans were meeting within their own caucuses for hours outside of when they typically do so. We're talking early in the morning in between sessions of the legislature, things like that. So I spoke with a couple of leaders who say negotiations with Democrats are still productive and ongoing, but they say that they want some kind of solid concession from Democrats if they're going to offer up any votes to raise taxes. I'm told changes to prevailing wage continue to come up, even after Democratic lawmakers and Governor Carney said that they were non-starters. So needless to say, I mean, it's going to be a long June 30th if they don't come up with anything soon.
There are also a bevy of sin taxes that moved out of House committee, alcohol, cigarette, e-cigs. How much are they expected to help, and do they have support?
Yeah, they're not really expected to help in the long term in any sort of sustaining way. So the revamped alcohol tax would raise about $7 million a year, with cigarette and, tobacco and tobacco product taxes clocking in at roughly $17 million. Lawmakers seem less likely to support these ideas because they're worried about losing business near the borders. They also say the increase isn't all that significant when you're talking about a $4.1 billion budget. And according to House Speaker Pete Schwarzkopf, the idea came out of these backroom negotiations with Republicans, and he's not necessarily interested in running the bills if he doesn't have to.
Coastal Zone Act revision bill advanced through the House pretty easily, but there were some amendments to that, including one that involved one of the more controversial areas, the bulk transfer items. Can you tell us what that does?
Yeah, so just quickly, when we talk about bulk products, we're talking about the big thing that environmentalists point to is oil, but it can be any kind of loose material commodity on a ship like gravel or grain. So what this amendment does is prevent businesses from setting up a depot along the shoreline. They couldn't, for instance, just bring in oil from land or sea or rail, whatever you have, without using it in some way. Now, this doesn't prevent the Delaware City Oil Refinery from applying for a permit to ship out their products, since they obviously convert crude oil into different sort of products. Overall, the bill's sponsor was just trying to ease concerns over storing any kind of bulk products along the coastline. So that bill just needs Senate approval and Governor Carney's signature to become law.
It kind of harkens back to there was an issue, I guess it was back late 90s, early 2000s, about liquefied natural gas in a port over across in New Jersey. It seems like that's kind of an echo of that. So it's something that people had some concerns about. An amendment was made for Bill Dismantling DDO, also now headed to the Senate. Again, a couple of amendments to deal with issues attached to that. What did they do?
One of them outlines a few conflict of interest requirements for the public-private partnership. For instance, board members would have to disclose any potential conflicts that the board is considering or will be voting on. And if they don't, they could be kicked out. The Second Amendment specifies what kinds of people will sit on the 15-member board. The governor co-chairs the group. A couple lawmakers are going to sit on it from the House and Senate. The governor then appoints at least a dozen more people, with half of them having to be recommended by influential business groups. We're talking Chamber of Commerce, Business Roundtable. It also doesn't require that board members pay any money for their seat, but it doesn't say it's forbidden either.
And finally, anything below the radar, things that have been kind of overshadowed by all these other issues, and specifically the budget that we should be hearing about or should know about?
I mean, there are always a few. One issue that's been somewhat controversial recently was this change in how charter schools give enrollment preferences. So a lot of people have complained about Newark Charter's five-mile circle for a while now. A bill that just needs Governor Carney's signature would eliminate that and force charters to use their home school districts as a preference if they want any kind of geographically based one. The rub here is that it specifically excludes the non-contiguous portion of Christina School District within Wilmington. So those kids would have little realistic chance of getting into Newark Charter without a preference, since the waiting list is over 3,000 kids. City lawmakers tried to unify the two bits of Christina in the bill twice, but got shot down both times. Carney's staff says they're reviewing the bill, but it's unclear if it will get signed.
All right. Well, we will see you one more time next week after the end of session. James Dawson, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
And remember, you keep up with James Dawson's coverage of politics in the First State anytime online at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in just a moment with an update on what's next at struggling Concord Mall. Stick around. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Back in March, contributor Eileen Dalabrida took a look at the future of shopping malls in the First State. Many malls nationwide are struggling, with one analyst predicting 400 will fold in the coming years. Some are trying to avoid that fate by reimagining themselves, but what about those here in Delaware? Well, back in March, Allied Retail Properties, owner of Concord Mall in North Wilmington, was tight-lipped about its plans for that site on Route 202 near the Pennsylvania line. This week, they opened up, and Eileen Dalabrida had more on what they had to say in her piece at DelawarePublic.org, and she joins us on The Green now to talk about what she found. Thanks for being with us, Eileen.
Good to be here, Tom.
Well, first off, what did Allied Properties have to say about the future of Concord Mall?
Well, they said that they are going to be making some big changes, although they were not specific about it. They said that they are going to reimagine the format of the property, the mix of tenants, the way it looks, but nothing written in stone.
And this isn't a big surprise. I mean, Concord Mall appears to be struggling like so many other malls. What are the specific issues that it faces right now?
Well, they face several issues. They have two anchors, Sears and Macy's, that are closing stores and really struggling. They also have had a number of smaller, popular retailers leave the mall, like PacSun and a few others, and they have not been able to attract new quality tenants to replace them.
Now, as you mentioned, Allied Retail isn't really showing its hand, and honestly, they may not even have a specific set of cards to play just yet. But can we glean anything from the other properties that they have here in Delaware, the Christiana Town Center, the Christiana Fashion Center, both of which are near the Christiana Mall? It would appear at first glance that they may be difficult to kind of duplicate at the Concord Mall site.
Well, Christiana Fashion Center, which is very successful, they are calling that a hybrid property, that it has a big blend of things, of big box stores, of smaller stores, of restaurants, and it's an open-air shopping center. And I think that when they look at the success of that property, we may be seeing some of that in the transformation of Concord Mall.
Should we also be looking at some of the other places that you mentioned in your previous piece, places like Plymouth Meeting Mall in Pennsylvania that turned to kind of unconventional anchors like Whole Foods and Legoland, or Echelon Mall in New Jersey, which is now the Voorhees Town Center. That used mixed-use development, shops, restaurants, service providers, offices, condos, apartments. Is that also a possibility at Concord Mall?
I think that we are not going to see things like housing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that the property is large enough to accommodate that, and I don't know if there's the demand. I also think that in terms of entertainment, that it's highly unlikely that we're going to see a multiplex theater, because there is one at Brandywine just up the road. So I think when you look around and you see what's available and what voids need to be filled, that does offer some clues as to what they might do or might not do. But I do think that non-traditional anchors will definitely be in play.
Any sense how long this will take to happen?
Well, we're looking at a very long-term project. When Christiana Mall did its transformation, and that was very successful, it took several years. They had two dark anchors, Lord & Taylor and the previously known as Strawbridge's store, and there's demolition, there's zoning, there's a lot to be done. So it's not anything that's going to be accomplished within the next year.
And you did check in with some local shoppers this week. What are they saying about this potential change?
Well, one of the things that I hear from shoppers that they like about Concord Mall is that it isn't a huge, sprawling property like Christiana, that they feel that it's comfortable there, that it's manageable, but that they don't find the kinds of stores that they want to see. They want to see more boutique shopping, more interesting retailers.
It's a fascinating thing to keep an eye on, and we will certainly do so. Eileen Dalabrida, thanks so much for your time this week.
Thanks, Tom.
And again, you can check out her story on Concord Mall and its future online at DelawarePublic.org. Next up, the Firefly Music Festival completed its sixth year in Dover last week. We take a look at how the event went and what its future may hold. Stay with us. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The 2017 edition of the Firefly Music Festival is in the books. Its sixth year at the Woodlands at Dover International Speedway appeared to go well, though many returning fans suggested attendance may have been lighter than in recent years. Contributor Rob Kaless was there covering the four-day event for us, checking out the local act performing, Dover-based rap group Trio, and looking into where Firefly stands after 6 years. You can read his pieces on Trio and Firefly's future right now at DelawarePublic.org. And I caught up with him earlier this week to discuss this year's event. So, Rob, before we get into the event itself, I wanted to ask you about the local act that performed Trio. They were relegated to sets on the campground rather than inside the festival. How did things work out for Trio this year?
I think they worked out pretty good. They seemed really excited to be there when I saw them on Saturday, even though they were set up on a new roving stage called the Rambler. It's not easy to get a crowd pumped up for a show at 11 a.m. on a Saturday, but I credit those guys from Trio for really bringing the same energy they did on Friday and Sunday. They got a total of 3 shows while they were there, even though they had only anticipated playing 2, but they were more than happy to play all 3. I think most bands just want to play for an audience no matter what, so in the end it worked out, even though they weren't on one of the main stages inside the Woodlands like Delaware bands in the past.
And regarding the festival itself, one thing that a number of fans noted, particularly those that had been there previously, was that crowds seem to be lighter this year. Firefly organizer Red Frog Events says, no, it estimates 90,000 for the weekend days. What was your impression being on the grounds of the crowd size?
I find it hard to believe that there were 90,000 people there, honestly, for Saturday or Sunday, Tom. I equate it to this. You know how a lot of times at baseball games, the announcers might say 50,000 paid attendance. But when you know the crowds are maybe half of that, perhaps that was the same issue here, that maybe Firefly sold the same or close to the same amount of wristbands, but just not everyone showed up or stuck around for certain acts. It's hard to say because it was clear that there was plenty of space for moving around, even for some of the higher profile acts. I can remember the VIP area by the main stage having to let one in for one out before the Foo Fighters show a few years ago. And on Sunday evening of this year's festival, before the shows by 30 Seconds to Mars and Muse, the place was half full.
And you did talk to the Red Frog people about some other possible explanations for why there seemed to be more room or things seemed to feel less crowded. What were some of the explanations that they were kind of giving you for why maybe things felt a little bit different than they had in years past?
Yeah, really, the only thing I think that changes from year to year is the lineup. And there are several people I know that had gone most years that had saw the lineup for this year and then decided to pass. It was very heavy on DJs and EDM artists, which I think appeals to a younger crowd. Now, granted, I'm 40, and I know a lot of people in their late 30s and early 40s who are making those complaints. But, you know, Red Frog Events, which has organized this event since its inception in 2012, has said that they are pretty happy with the way things currently are and, you know, seem to be really happy with the way the weather was and the crowds were good. So I think they're pretty happy with the way things went overall, even though they might not be willing to admit that it may have been a down year, at least in terms of numbers.
And they had said that perhaps things were organized better, that perhaps things were laid out better. But I gather from what you're saying is that those type of things, even if they did have an impact, didn't have the kind of big impact that would explain away that feeling that was less crowded.
I don't think so. I think it really comes down to the lineup. I think from year to year, you know, they might change up the amenities and, you know, expand on some of the bars and the food options and whatnot. But I think when they kind of take a look at things after the dust has settled and get some fan feedback, they might kind of, I don't know if they would on the record go back on what they said about 90,000 people, but they might look at it as kind of a wake-up call that, you know, changing the lineup as drastically as I felt they did this year, leaning heavily on EDM and DJs and hip-hop and foregoing more of the traditional four- and five-piece bands that play instruments. I think once they see that fan reaction in the aftermath, they might consider, you know, tipping the scales back toward a more balanced festival next year.
Which I guess comes as a bit of a surprise, maybe perhaps to the organizers who build this year's Firefly as a fan curated event. The idea that you were kind of responding to fans, did that maybe just not work out as well as they thought it would? Or maybe they really were talking inside maybe a bubble with certain fans?
It's possible. I mean, I think the fan experience has always been a top priority for Firefly. You know, if the fans aren't happy and don't come back, there is no festival. However, this idea of being fan curated, which you heard a lot from the Red Frog people this year, I think speaks directly to the amenities, but to a greater extent, the lineup. If Red Frog is following fan commentary primarily on social media, they're seeing what the younger fans want, which is evident from this year's lineup. I just think they need to realize that there are a lot of fans out there, maybe in an older age bracket, as I mentioned, that just don't use social media as much. And so they might feel like they don't have as much of a voice in the matter or as much of a say in the matter. I'm really hoping that we get back to the likes of Beck and Tom Petty and Vampire Weekend and the Lumineers. I think those are the acts that put this festival on the map. I think there's room for a good mix of EDM and DJ alongside your prototypical bands. But I think this year the former was favored over the latter.
So maybe there was a bit of a social media echo chamber that the Firefly kind of got caught in. Even if their numbers were right, let's say, or close to right, around 90,000, maybe if it was even, let's say, you know, 70 or 80,000, it does feel like that Firefly has hit a bit of a plateau. Is there any possibility Firefly would consider expanding further? Can they even expand on the site at the Woodlands?
Yeah, I talked to some of the representatives while I was there from Red Frog. You know, they've organized this event since its inception in 2012. They've seen it grow and expand. And they said that they're pretty happy with their current footprint. And if anything, they would expand on the amount of days, perhaps including a second weekend before expanding the grounds or the amount of attendees. In 2011, South by Southwest in Austin, Texas moved to 10 days. They used to be a four-day weekend, and they started to include interactive media events lasting 5 days, music for 6 days, and films running concurrently for 9 days. Now, that's a different kind of a festival, sure, but if Firefly were to go to 10 days or 2 weekends, I don't see how they could avoid opening the lineup to more than just musical acts.
It's an interesting prospect, particularly in a city like Dover, which may not have maybe the kind of venues that in Austin, Texas, or some other places might have to have these kind of secondary events.
Yeah, it would be tough. I mean, you would definitely have to get more of Dover Downs involved, you know, the Rollins Center and venues like that, and even other smaller bars or, you know, some sort of movie houses or theaters for any kind of film screenings. And that's a major undertaking. I don't know if Firefly would want to get outside of the Woodlands. I don't necessarily think they should, but if they look toward 2 weekends, that's a lot of music to book. You know, especially with the popularity of festivals. You know, there are a lot of bands that played Firefly that also played Coachella, and Bonnaroo. So you get close to overlap. If they were to go 8 days, 240 weekends, maybe it's doable. That's something they have to consider. But it seems like they would rather grow the days first before growing the footprint of the Woodlands itself, or trying to bump up the attendees into, 100,000 a day on the weekend.
And the other part of that equation is Dover International Speedway, which owns the grounds. They obviously have this event, Firefly. They have their two NASCAR races every year. What about Dover International Speedway? Are they looking to do anything more with these grounds outside of Firefly and these NASCAR races?
Yeah, when I spoke with Gary Camp, who's the Assistant Vice President of Marketing and Communications for Dover International Speedway, which obviously is separate from Dover Downs. I mean, the International Speedway is the speedway side of things and the racing and the Woodlands that they lease, whereas Dover Downs is more the casino side of things and the hotel side of things. He said that he felt like, at least for Dover International Speedway, this Firefly is very much a resume builder for the venue itself. He mentioned actually a live production of the TV show American Ninja Warrior, despite negotiations with their producers falling through. But he mentioned that as some of the possibilities for the venue itself. We all know what happened with Punk and Chunkin and the insurance issues there, but Dover International Speedway, that system, that organization has helped with even with off-site events like Dogfish Head's Analog of Go-Go, which was held for the first time in New Castle County last year. I mean, if they can manage Firefly and two NASCAR events and off-site events, then I think the sky is the limit for the Speedway and for their staff. If they were to, continue to host big events there, they might have to bring Dover Downs and the Rollins Center, into the equation. I don't know how that would work contractually because it seems like they're two separate entities.
Right.
But I think they've run things pretty darn well for Firefly. I mean, even this year with the numbers being down as I see them, it's still run incredibly smooth. I mean, you didn't really see much involvement with police. You didn't hear about many fights, and security was in pretty good shape, and logistics and flow, and all those issues with traffic from a few years back seem to have dissipated. So I think they've got a pretty good handle on how to run a major four-day festival.
Thanks to contributor Rob Kaless for his time this week. And again, you can check out his reporting on Firefly online at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. A new History Matters is next. It's part two in our series looking at jazz in Wilmington. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Last week, History Matters, produced in collaboration with the Delaware Historical Society, looked at the legacy of Wilmington's renowned jazz teacher, Robert Boise Lowry. Our Jazz in Wilmington series continues this week with a glimpse into the complex life of one of Lowry's students and one of Wilmington's most widely received jazz musicians, Lem Winchester. Delaware Public Media's Megan Pauly brings us his story.
Over the last 30 years, Scott Davidson has led various music ensembles in Delaware. Like so many others, he also sought out musical guidance from the late Boise Lowry. However, it was another musician and student of Lowry's who really caught Davidson's attention.
Over the years, I kept hearing Lem Winchester's name.
Davidson discovered that he'd recorded music on major labels like Prestige, now Concord Records. That was over 15 years ago when Davidson set out to uncover the story of the Bop Cop, as Lem Winchester became known. Lem was a policeman, but his passion was music. Davidson says he'd play often at a restaurant in the Governor Prince Boulevard Merchandise Mart shopping center.
He used to take off his gun when he would do the night shift. He'd come to the restaurant in his police uniform, take off his gun, and start playing the vibes. And then he would go to work.
It was there that Lem got to know the John Chowning Trio. Eventually, one of Chowning's distant relatives who worked with RCA Records invited Lem to be a guest on one of their recordings in New York City.
Then John Chowning's father sent a recording to a well-known jazz critic named Leonard Feather, who anybody in jazz knows who Leonard Feather is.
Feather was in charge of booking new artists, and he gave Lem his big break, inviting him to perform at the 1958 Newport Jazz Festival.
They didn't give him enough money to bring his regular rhythm section from Wilmington, so he used a rhythm section from the Herb Pomeroy Big Band.
He was featured on one side of a New Faces of Newport album and was flooded with opportunities. Lem began billing himself as the Lionel Hampton of Wilmington and recorded more and more music.
And he used people like Art Taylor and Max Roach, and he did an album with Benny Golson.
By 1960, he'd recorded several albums already.
Yeah, that's a lot. In a two-year time span, that is a great deal. It's unheard of.
That's Shirley Scott, who, like Davidson, developed a keen interest in Lem's family. She's the author of B Street Family Ties, detailing the interweaving of the Wilkerson, Winchester, and Davis families on B Street in Wilmington's Southbridge community. Lem came from humble beginnings. He was born in 1928 to Mary Ann Davis, a single mother. William Wilkerson took them both in and married Davis, but he introduced baby Lemuel to his relatives, the Winchesters, who eventually adopted him. Davidson again.
Apparently, if you had a family who was poor and they had a lot of kids, and there was another couple that couldn't have kids, and it was very common for that couple to adopt one from another family.
Together, Lem's mom and William Wilkerson had 14 kids, including Millie, later to become Millie Cannon, a well-known jazz vocalist in the area. Lem grew up directly across the street from his mom and multiple step-siblings, and as Scott detailed in her book, that proximity helped forge a musical connection.
Lem, her Uncle Joe, who's also a musician, their grandfather, they would be at the dinner table after the meal. Lem would have the spoons, the grandfather would have the ukulele, and her father, Millie's father, wasn't a musical man, so he was the one tapping his foot a lot.
Maurice Sims grew up with Lem.
My oldest friend. See, Lem could play the piano. Never had a lesson. He get on that thing, man. Play like Lionel Hampton. Imitate Lionel Hampton. You ever hear Lionel Hampton do the two fingers thing? Billy do dun. But Lem could do that all up and down the piano. Make you cry. He played so good.
That musical ability developed at a young age.
Lem, I get on the piano. Lem get on the violin. Press was working up post office. He's chasing me out of the post. We sneak in his apartment. That's when Lem. We sneak in there. Lem just started to vibe. Press's vibes in there. I said, man, that don't sound too bad.
Scott says Millie's second husband eventually gave his vibes to Lem.
He said Lem was so good. This is Millie telling me the story. Lem was so good that he didn't want to get on the vibes anymore. He gave Lem his vibes. Go ahead, man. You take it. You got it. And he went back to the keyboard, and that was it. He was done with the vibes after that.
But Lem's quality of life differed from his 14 step-siblings. Lem's adopted father, William Winchester, made a good salary as a city councilman.
He was privileged in the sense that his uncle Winchester and his aunt Bert gave him whatever. He had a boat. He had stuff that other kids in the community didn't have.
Davidson says Mr. Winchester, who in 1945 became the first black representative in the legislature, also helped Lem get a job.
So he pulled strings and got his son a job as a cop, because which was at that time a really good job for an African American.
However, Lem's career as a cop soon came to a screeching halt.
The unpleasant part of the story is that he had a fight with his wife, and it was physical. And his mother-in-law called the cops. The cops came to the house, took her statement, and he was going to be thrown out of the police force with a hearing. So before he had the hearing, he decided to resign.
Davidson uncovered this fact by obtaining Lem's police records with the help of former Mayor James Baker.
Unlike everybody else around him, he understood why I would want this file to write a biography, especially since I hardly had any documents from any other place. So about 6 days later, I'm sitting in the police department's office of the chief of the police, and he's going page by page in the file and giving me the file, and then he said there was something he wasn't going to give me, which was really kind of annoying. So I'll never know exactly what that is. I mean, I don't know what could be more embarrassing than being charged with battery and run out of the police department. I don't know what other detail in the file is more embarrassing than that. I have no idea.
After resigning from the police force, Lem turned to music full-time.
I think there was probably, from what I hear from his brother George, pressure to keep a stable job because he had three kids and he had to support them. And it was kind of insane to suddenly decide, I think I'll be a jazz musician to support my three kids.
Shirley Scott says in conversations with Millie Cannon, she suspected Lem might be bipolar.
She said, you know, I believe that's what was wrong with Lem. And had we really known and paid attention, you know, that maybe he could have gotten the help that he needed, you know, because he would really fly off the handle and the mood swings were very present.
Sometimes those mood swings would present themselves as temper tantrums.
He had a pattern of temper tantrums that were very, very dangerous. He loved guns. He kept guns. He shot at Millie a few times.
Not only was he fixated on guns, but he was also obsessed with risk-taking and would line his siblings up in the backyard, shooting apples or cans off of their heads. His risk-taking personality carried over into all aspects of his life. Davidson again.
He used to set off firecrackers in the police locker room so people would think they were gunshots. Kind of crazy stuff like that.
Sims recalls his reckless nature on his motorcycle, standing up on it and riding carelessly with both of his sons. Eventually, his mother successfully persuaded him to give up the motorcycle, bribing him with a car instead.
You give up the motorcycle, I'll buy you a car. She bought him a 46 Chrysler. I never been brand new, just for him to get off that motorcycle with them boys. He had one up in the front here, and then back flying through the project.
But eventually, this reckless attitude caught up with Lem just a year after leaving the police force.
He had a headache, so he asked the bartender for an aspirin. So when the bartender opened the drawer, he was actually the owner of the club, too. Lem Winchester saw that he had a gun. So Lem Winchester said, let me show you this trick I used to do with my police service revolver. So he used to take out all the bullets except one, and he used to put it to his head and go click and scare the living daylights out of his friends.
But this time, his Russian roulette trick didn't work.
So he screwed up the trick and blew his brains out. And it's my theory that that's why he hasn't gotten his due as far as being honored in Wilmington and recognized, even though 50 years after his death, there are record companies that are putting out his CDs.
Davidson insists Lem wasn't suicidal, and Shirley Scott agrees.
There were things lined up for him. So I know that this was the last thing on his mind when he played the game that he normally played, but he did not have his service revolver. And that, you know, that was the end of that.
Davidson says everything went downhill for Lem's family and his legacy after his death.
Lem Winchester's mother-in-law, after Lem accidentally shot himself, his mother-in-law, who didn't like him, took all of his sheet music and recordings and dumped them in the trash.
His wife was forced to find work as a domestic worker. Life wasn't easy for Lem's children either, or the community. But many, like Sims, choose to remember Lem for the musical legacy he's left behind.
Last thing I heard him play was at the Round Table playing Polka Dots and Moonbeams. I always thought that was his favorite song anyhow.
One of his favorite Lem Winchester tunes, Down Fuzz.
Down mean you hip, you know everything, you know all these, so he was a down fuzz.
The copyright has expired on Lem's music, and Scott says his family doesn't receive any royalties from the companies in the U.S. and abroad putting out his music today.
But one thing that they do benefit from, and that's from being in the same family and having these two people to share. Millie and Lem.
For Delaware Public Media, I'm Megan Polly.
Thanks, Megan. And stay with us. Enlighten Me is next with a piece from our Generation Voice Youth Media Project. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The school year here in Delaware just ended, and that means another year of our Generation Voice Youth Media Project at Mount Pleasant High School in the Brandywine School District is also complete. And over the next couple of weeks here in Enlighten Me, we want to highlight some of the work done by students in that project. First up, a piece that builds on one we aired earlier this year by Mount Pleasant High School sophomore Maya Williams on the so-called school-to-prison pipeline, students getting in trouble at school and ultimately ending up in prison. Through that story, she heard about alternative schools and the role they play in that journey. So Maya joined forces with fellow sophomore Jada Thomas to investigate how alternative schools work in Delaware.
Hi, my name's Maya.
And I'm Jada.
We're both sophomores at Mount Pleasant High School, and we're here today to talk about alternative schools.
We're both inner-city kids. We've seen firsthand how many of our classmates from elementary to middle and now high school end up in alternative schools.
But we've never been to one, so we wanted to investigate how students end up there, what the environment is like, and if they change students for better or for worse.
This is Shada again. Most of my friends who've been to alternative schools don't necessarily see them as bad. They said that they're jumping, fun, exciting. Basically, they feel like they can get away with anything.
This is Maya. I've only lived in Delaware for a few years, but it didn't take me long to become familiar with the Wilmington area. It's a very small, tight-knit city. There's an energy here, and it's like all the kids feed off of each other. If someone sees a friend getting shipped off to an alternative school, they want to go too, because they're sort of a family dynamic. Setting our own preconceived notions aside, we decided to call up the State Department of Education to ask them how alternative schools in Delaware work. We talked to John Sadowski, who's in charge of discipline.
So alternative placement is for students that have, it's primarily for chronic and repetitive disciplinary issues within the regular school setting. Although it can be for more severe one-time incidents as well.
Alternative schools determine how long the student's placement may last, ranging anywhere from 30 to 90 days based on academics, attendance, and behavior.
Those are the three biggies. If you're making like outstanding progress, we'll kind of do a reevaluation at that point and see if we can transition you back earlier.
And while Delaware school districts are able to establish their own codes of conduct, Sadowski says they are very similar. But not every district has its own alternative school.
What we have is the legislation that created this years ago said that each of the county school districts could come together and form a consortium rather than providing this individual programming in their schools you know, to kind of scale it where it's cheaper to provide that service by combining forces. So that's what all the counties have done.
But we're not sure the cheapest option is the best, and we have our doubts about how well alternative schools are working. So we talked to Malik Muhammad, head of Parkway Schools.
Our mission is to serve and transform young people.
One of the mental health methods he says Parkway has adopted is the restorative practice method,
which is a model that's designed to build relationships, to have a balance between control and challenge, and holding people accountable also with a heavy dose of support.
Muhammad says their statistics are proof that the method is working.
97% in various years, but around 97% of the students that come to a Parkway school have fewer days of out-of-school suspension than when they did when they're in their traditional environment.
But he also says just because things are good inside the school doesn't mean things are good outside of school.
I'm bothered by the number of students across the board at Parkway or otherwise that we lose to homicide every year. So what bothers me and something that I think we need to look at is across the board, all schools in New Castle County, public schools, alternative schools, et cetera, how many young men, especially young men of color, Black and Latino boys, are being killed? I think that needs to be a measure of our success as well.
Dr. Kim Allen, director of Brandywine Community School, an alternative school serving Brandywine School District students, has firsthand experience with how guns impact students in the school environment.
We do talk about consequences all the time, though, and I think that's really important. Does somebody really say, do you know what the consequence of you doing this could mean? We've had a young man recently, a young middle school boy, hanging out with some older boys, and they were in the, you know, park, and a police car rolled up, and the older boy said, oh, just hold this. And the younger boy thought it was just a play gun or something. And of course, he got stuck with the gun. And, you know, unfortunately, but one of the nice things we do, I mean, we have relationships with the courts. We will go to the courts if we have to. I will go to the court personally and try to speak on behalf of a student. And I think that's one of the pluses that we can do as a program that schools just don't have the time to do. I know they would do it, but we're fortunate, and I feel very blessed that we can do it and make a difference for students.
Dr. Allen says trauma plays a huge role in the performance of students, not only academically, but also behaviorally.
Nowadays, trauma is very big in the schools, and our children are dealing with a lot of trauma. But unfortunately, as we find, a lot of times schools aren't aware of this because they're so large that a student has seen a parent shot, a family that's homeless, a family that's had to move as a result of violence in the community.
She recalls a heartbreaking moment working with a student who's experienced trauma.
One of the saddest situations I ever had was I had a young lady who came to us and told us that she had a stepfather or her mother's boyfriend that was physically abusing her. And she really didn't want to tell her mom because her mom was happy. And it just cut me to my core, you know. And she said, you know, my mom's not ever been this happy, and I don't want to be the one to tell this. And I said to her, you know, we were mandated reporters. We have to report. She said, well, will you talk to my mom with me? We said, of course we will. And, you know, obviously we proceeded with that. But those are the things that I won't say that they, obviously they're very, you know, troubling, but I'm happy that we're there, that we can catch that. Because if not, you know, a young lady like that in a big school could be lost with something like that.
She says the school focuses on parent involvement as a necessary component of student wellness.
But the good news, I think, for us is we can meet with our families. Families must meet with us. We have an intake where parents must attend. We go out to homes. We have home visits. We have family nights. We do what we can to encourage family interaction and support for that family, and not just the student that's in our school, but for the entire family.
Sometimes, despite all the support, it just isn't enough.
We certainly have students that return. I mean, there are some students that it can be due to family circumstance. It can be due to things in the community. There are a lot of things out of our control. The saddest things are when I have to go to a service or something for a student that, you know, may have gotten caught up in something in the community. And, you know, we just wish we had have been there.
We talked to Mr. Simmons, a teacher here at Mount Pleasant, who identifies the types of students who are more likely to be sent to an alternative school.
It's normally the kids who have lower test grades or poor academics are the ones who go to the alternative school. And from what the data shows, that's normally kids from what we could consider, quote unquote, lesser backgrounds.
Simmons says that some students are unmotivated and their placement has nothing to do with teacher qualifications or the relationships teachers establish with their students.
What else do you want them to do? Sometimes there is nothing that they can really do because the student is hell-bent on going in the direction that they want to be in. As much as I don't like to say it, but there is a need for kids who cannot conform to the behavior requirements of an academic environment need to be placed in an alternative setting so that the others can be successful.
However, he understands that when a student does go to an alternative school, it can hurt them academically.
I do know that kids who come from an alternative program, or if they go to an alternative school and come back, are normally behind. So obviously it's not adequate because those kids aren't in the same place that they would be if they were in a regular school.
We also spoke to Ms. Jeter, a paraeducator here at Mount Pleasant. She was previously employed at Brandywine Community School. While she couldn't speak for all alternative schools, she was confident in her old school's success. But she felt the same way Simmons did about the transition from alternative back to regular school.
The only drawback or con, I would say, is that sometimes students lose a lot while they're there. When it comes, once they return back to school in the academic setting, they lose that skill of this is what it means to be a student in a large population of students.
A lot of the students Jeter works with at Mount are kids she established relationships with while working at the Brandywine Community School.
One student in particular, like even though like the staff may see him as disrespectful to them, he still greets me with, hey, Ms. Jeter, what's up? And I get where he's coming from. Mm-hmm. And I can redirect him without getting cursed out.
Jeter said this student in particular has come a long way. While he's still getting in trouble at the high school level, at least he knows what his triggers are. Ms. Jeter says he was missing discipline at home and wasn't used to being held accountable for his actions and had the consequences attached to them in the school setting. She says getting him acclimated to that now is a work in progress.
Throughout the process of reporting on alternative schools, we learned that people will only talk about what they're comfortable with. We reached out to Parkway Academy and the Brandywine Community School in an effort to add a student's perspective, but we weren't given access. We also talked to counselors at our own school to see if any current students who've been through alternative schools would be willing to talk to us. They weren't. Even some adults didn't feel comfortable answering all questions. Some, like Mr. Simmons, were more candid about their opinions of alternative schools. He has serious concerns about grouping kids with similar behavior issues together at the same alternative school.
It's almost like incarceration in a sense. You know how they say incarceration doesn't rehabilitate criminals, it just makes better criminals? That's my feeling. Kids learn tricks from other kids who are getting in trouble. They have more deep conversations because they spend more time with other kids who get in trouble, which, you know, increases their practice. They learn how to get away with things. They do more things.
We learned that there are many components that factor into an alternative school success. It's sort of like baking a cake. If you don't have all of your ingredients, it's not going to turn out right. Some of the key factors include teacher training, family involvement, mental health interventions, and teacher-student relationships. Mr. Simmons feels there's a way to prevent kids from ending up in alternative schools in the first place, and we agree. We definitely feel that there needs to be a greater emphasis on early intervention so that we can prevent future generations of students from cycling through alternative schools.
I really believe that if we can educate these kids before they get to third grade, I think that would eliminate a lot of the issues that they have once they get to middle school and high school.
While we don't have enough information to declare all alternative schools in Delaware a success or failure, we do know that we need to start changing the community stigma surrounding alternative schools.
Schools should be safe places where students aren't afraid to ask for help. And unfortunately, intervention now doesn't come until they've already started to drift down the wrong path.
For Generation Voice, I'm Maya.
For Generation Voice, I'm Jada.
And we say thanks to Mount Pleasant High School sophomores Maya Williams and Jada Thomas for enlightening us this week. Generation Voice is made possible through our partnership with the Brandywine School District and Mount Pleasant's student radio station WMPH. Megan Pauly is our youth media producer there. And that's all we have time for on The Green this week. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributors Eileen Dalabrida and Rob Kaless, Mount Pleasant High School sophomores Maya Williams and Jada Thomas from Generation Voice, Delaware Public Media's James Dawson and Megan Pauly, as well as our president and station manager Casey House. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.